My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I haven't found necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981, and so I'm in my Thank you. I'm in my 45th year of sobriety, and I'm so glad. There's so many people to thank, and I'll forget them all, and I don't know all their names. And obviously, I've met so many great people like Val, and I've met Kenna on the way over here, and she's fantastic from the Pacifica group. And so many people, I got some people that I know that I see on Zoom all the time. We have a lot of Zoom meetings that I get involved in, and you can't hear me here.
Yeah, I can't hear you. I got to talk into the mic.
We got a lot of Zoom meetings that I'm involved in. I go to, so you give an idea about my deal. I go to three Zoom meetings. I go to a 7 a.m. in the morning. I roll out of bed, you know, and I go to a 7 o'clock Zoom meeting called Serenity Now, and with about 40 people from all over the world, and who I've been going to those meetings for about 5 or 6 years. And I love them, and I get to meet them all the time, wherever I go, and they come on down and everything like that. And then at 12 o'clock, I go to a men's Zoom meeting from people from all over the world. And then at 4 o'clock, I go to my home group, which is a South Dixie virtual meeting where there's about 40, 50 people. And Friday nights, I do a Christian recovery thing at 7 o'clock, and we get about 60, 70 people, and it's a three-hour meeting, and they don't want to leave. I can't get them to leave. Yeah. I said, and then on Saturday mornings, we do a three to four-hour workshop with about 70, 80 people and from all over the world, and doing that for 6 years. They don't want to leave. So, and then every once in a while I'm blessed. Somebody asked me to do a step series, which I don't know whether you have step series here. And they ask people to spend 3 months, you know, maybe once a day, whatever it is, a Wednesday or Thursday, to come up somewhere. And we do steps 1 through 12, and they pick somebody who's been around for a while, and I get to do that. So I'm pretty much involved in the deal. It's a blessing. It's a blessing. Great blessing. It's a blessing for me to be here, to meet all you people, incredible people. I'll tell you a little bit about my story. I don't take myself too seriously. That's become very important to me. I don't judge people. You know, I treat everybody like they have a broken heart, because they probably do. But I can tell you this. I can tell a lot about a person by what gets them upset. I can tell a lot about a person. You know, there's something in the book that's called the spiritual axiom. You know, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what cause, there's something wrong with you. So I'm probably going to say some things to disturb you, because ever since I've lost fear of people, and I used to be so worried about what some guy in the front row who doesn't even pay my visa bill might think about me, you know. So I used to filter my stuff, you know. Somewhere along the line, it says that if we do this thing right, whatever right means to you, you're going to lose fear of people. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, so I used to tell myself all the time, I don't care what people think about. In the bar, I don't give a crap what they think about me. But you know what you learn when you start seeing yourself is you learn that people that tell themselves all the time they don't give a crap what people think about them, or tell other people they don't care what other people think about them, all they do is think about what other people think about them. Because people that really do not, nobody can hear me? You can. Can anybody hear me? It's you. It's you and one other guy in the back, and you know, it's tough. I don't know what to tell you if it bothers you, you know. You have to say, it's not me, you know. It could be me, but I don't care, you know, but if you really don't care what other people think about, you know. I used to sell myself stuff. People that really don't care what other people think about them don't say things like, I don't care. They say things like pass the ketchup, but they don't say that crap. So, you know, that's the deal. So I'm just going to let it rip and talk about what I'm supposed to talk about in AA. What are you supposed to talk about in AA? Well, you know, I got to tell you, I read the big book. I read 12 and 12, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers over and over again. I love Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And a lot of different other books, you know, because AA is really a launching pad for me. It's not a coffin. It used to be a coffin, but it's a launching pad, you know. It's a launching pad, not because I'm a good guy or I'm spiritual. I'm not spiritual. I mean, there's a lot of people in AA that are spiritual, not religious. And I used to be spiritual, not religious. And then what happened was life and worldly clamors caught up with me, like caught up with Bill when he was 22 years sober. And he wrote The Next Frontier, and he had to take it to a higher level. And so what I talk about today, and don't be surprised, is I talk about what I think the big book tells me to talk about. He says each alcoholic in his own language, from his own point of view, talks about how he built his relationship with God. At least that's what my big book says. You, maybe in Canada, they got a different big book. I don't know. So I'm just going to, I'm so happy to meet Jim. 70 years. So humble, so kind, so wonderful. He came up to me, introduced himself, told me he had 70 or 72 years and that he spits on 45 years. I mean, forget, yeah. No, I lied about that. That's something I would say to one of my sponsees who has 25 years. If he said something to me like, well, you don't understand, I'd say, listen, when you were picking up your white chip, I already had 25 years. You know what I mean? I'd be mean like that. I'm not a nice sponsor. You know, I spoke here, not here. I spoke in Banff like around 16, 17 years ago. And I spoke here in Calgary about 15 years ago or something like that. And I figured, the way I figured it is so much time has gone by that it's probably safe to come back up again because they don't remember, you know. I was speaking in Toronto around 20 years ago or something, and some guy, you know, about Jim, he said, I just want to tell you I have to leave early. I said, I really appreciate you telling me that because I was speaking at a regional in Toronto about 20 years ago, and there was a lot of people. It was more than, you know, and I did my talk like I'm doing here. It almost looked like this crowd, and at the very end of the talk, you know, I spoke for, you know, whatever it is, the hour, whatever it is. And at the very end, the last 5 minutes of the talk, in the back of the room, it was much bigger. In the back of the room, I saw a guy get up and walk out the door. And in my mind, it flashed through. You know, alcohol is but a symptom of the disease. The real disease centers in our mind, not our body, at least my mind, not my body. You see, if you tell me you're an alcoholic, I know you're a please love me a holic. Don't reject me a holic. What are you thinking about me a holic? You got so many holic things going on. You spend money. You don't have to buy crap. You don't even need to impress people you don't even like. You're constantly worried what people think about you. You walk out of me and you say, why did I say that? Why did I do that? What am I going to say? No, I can't say that. It's second guessing you. There's so many holic things going on. And so here I am. And I don't know how much time I had then, 20 years or something. Some guy walks out of the room and I'm in the first, he goes right and says, what did I say? What did I say? Why did he leave? You know, and they're driving me to the airport. And the guys in the car are saying, you know what A.A. saying? You know, that was really great. We loved you and everything like that. And they all applauded for me and everything like that. And all I'm thinking, I said, what did I say? What did that guy leave? I can't stop thinking about why that guy left. Every once in a while, I meet a guy from Toronto. Anybody out of town? Yeah, I'm from Toronto. I said, were you in a meeting 20 years ago? You're the son of a guy. You're that guy who left, aren't you? You know? I've decided that his wife was giving birth to quintuplets and he wasn't even supposed to be there, but he couldn't drag himself away or something like that. I don't know. So I bought myself an Alky dog the other day. I did. So I was so glad that Jim told me he's going to leave. Because I only have like 44 and a half years, and you know, what's the point of staying anyway? So in any event, he didn't say that. I'm blind, but that's what I figured he meant. But in any event, so I bought an Alky dog. So I was driving in my neighborhood, and there was a sign, talking dog for sale, $10. And, you know, wouldn't you stop? I stopped. I said, you got talking dog to sale? And he says, oh, yeah, he's in the back. He talks. He said, yeah, he talks. You got a dog that talks in the back. Yeah. He says, they're for sale. Yeah. Can I go see him? Can I talk to him? Felt stupid. Yeah. He said, yeah, he's back there. His name's Max. So I said, okay. So I walk back. There's a scrawny little dog. Looks like he's 2 million years old. He's in a cage in the back. I said, hi, how you doing? He says, hi, I'm fine. I said, you talk? He says, yeah, I talk. I said, your name's Max? He says, yeah, Max. I said, you're a talking dog? He says, yeah. How long have you been? Ever since I was a pup. I said, it's like amazing. I've never heard of a talking dog before. He says, oh, yeah. He says, yeah, I've been talking for a long time. He says, well, what's your story? He says, well, I worked for the CIA for about 20 years in Russia. And the guy who owned me was one of the top guys in the the KGB at that time. And I used to go to the Kremlin and go to all the meetings, and they didn't pay attention to me because I'm a dog. So then I had a handler, CIA handler, and I'd come back and I'd debrief him about what happened at the meetings and everything like that. And I did that for about 20 years, and then they sort of retired me, and I came back to the States, and I started working in industrial espionage. And I started working for Monsanto. And the guy, they bring me over to meetings like in Dow Chemical or, 3M or something like that, and listen to what's going on, their latest experiments and everything like that. And then I debriefed the, my handlers in Monsanto, and I did that for about 10 years, and then I'm retired, and now. And that's my story, and that's what I do. I said, man, this is unbelievable. The world needs to know about this. They ought to do some sort of movie. It says, yeah, they're going to do a movie, and I'm already talking to some people, and there's going to be a movie coming out, and, that's the deal, and that's my story. He says, well, listen, you don't know me. I got a wife, and I got a bunch of kids and grandkids and everything like that. I live right down the street, as a matter of fact, And I'm going to talk to your boss about maybe you come and live with us. He says, yeah, no problem. I'm fine. I'm cool with that. And I said, so I went back to the guy. I said, so I spoke to your dog. And he says, it's okay for me to, he'll come and live with me. He says, yeah, no problem. I said, so how much for the dog? He says, can't you read the sign? $10. I said, you got a talking dog back there. He says, yeah. I said, your only son. $10, it's a talking, you're selling for $10? He says, listen, he's a flipping liar. He didn't do any of that crap. Alcoholic dog, unbelievable. Yeah, man, don't trust them alkies, I'll tell you what. I made that up, by the way. I know you guys knew that, but there was one guy in the back, he's not that sharp, It's just... wanted to tell him that. So I'm with the story. Okay, I'm with the story. We'll do a story. I'll tell you about myself. I won't lecture, preach to you or anything like that. I took care of that this morning if you're at the workshop. So what's the deal? I drank because this is why I drank. I drank for the noble art of getting bombed. I didn't drink for the taste. I got to sip a lot of, and then I drank, and then I, drunk a lot, and then I drank, and then I drank, and then I drank, and then, why focus on that? There's some newcomers here. They know why they know they have a drinking problem. That's why they're here. What I want to get to is I want to get to the next frontier, emotional sobriety. I'm going to get through the drunkalogue, which is important. It was important for me. Thank God I had drunkalogues, and I have to get to the faithalogues. Because all men of faith have courage. Did you know that? I didn't make that up. All men of faith have courage. Men that don't have faith are cowards. You know that? They suffer from fear. They worry about what people think about them. They're worried about what they're going to say. They worry about whether you're going to like them. I was your basic whore for the world. I'm going to be whatever you want me to be as long as you like me. The worst thing an alcohol can hear is, what they were saying about you last night? The worst. Oh my God, it kills you. That's the deal. It's all about the fear. And, I want you to love me. I want you to accept me. I don't want to take any chances or any risks. If I talk in a meeting, I'm walking away thinking I'm second guessing myself. Why did I say that? Why didn't I say that? I'm always worried what people are thinking about me. Although I'm telling myself I don't care what people think about me. And that's the true alcoholism, isn't it? The bondage to other people and worrying about whether, they say you can't love God and mammon, but what I want more than anything else is I want you to like me. I'll do anything. If I'm with a group of Nazis, I'll become a Nazi. If I'm with a group of racists, I'll become, I'm going to be whatever you want me to be because I have no integrity whatsoever, although I tell myself I do. I mean, I don't know what kind of alcoholism you have. That's the kind of alcoholism I have. And I drank because no woman, no car, no amount of money, no suit of clothes, no nothing ever worked as well for me as just a few drinks. And if it worked for me today the way it worked for me when I was like 18, 19, 20 years old, believe me, I'd still be drinking it, but alcohol stopped working for me. And so I don't drink it. And the sad news about my life is that alcohol stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me. And I hurt a lot of people. And that's what happened to me. And I can tell you, you know, when you first come in, whenever I finally got a chance to speak or I got a chance to speak, because I would sit in my throne of contempt in the back of the room, you know, because I graduated with Department of Law and Mathematics. I was going for a PhD in algebraic topology. I ultimately became a lawyer, and that's another thing I'll get. I became a lawyer and became a division chief of the state's attorney's office, trying murder cases and major crimes and everything like that. So I knew everything. I knew everything, you know. I was a big shot. Unfortunately, that's all I knew. I didn't know how to keep a marriage together, and I didn't know how to be a decent human being. I knew all the other stuff, and now I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm 76 years old, and I only know two or three things. But those two or three things, I'm solid on. And I've unknown everything else I used to know. But you'd be surprised at what you can do on just knowing a couple of things instead of lies that you tell yourself. So in any event, so I did the intergroup banquet chair thing, part of my service when I came to AA, and I brought Clancy. When I first came in, my mother, who died with 19 years sobriety, gave me a tape of Clancy's, and it was a tape from his Tar Heel convention in 1980, the year before. And when I drive in the office, I would listen to that tape. It took about an hour. It took the same time to drive in the office that I could listen to that tape. So I'd listen to it on the way into the office. I listened to it on the way out of the office. I listened to it on the way. Did that for a year, 2 years. I could memorize the tape. I could do his story. It was like unbelievable. And so when I got to the point where I was like 3 or 4 or 5 years sober and I became the group banquet chairman for 2 years and I would bring people down. First guy I brought down was Johnny Harris, and second from the Pacific, well, he's Bellflower Group, and then Clancy, because I love that. I loved him. I love that tape. You know, I love listening to tapes. I love listening to, you know, circuit speakers. And I used to sit in the back of the room for an Amy, you know, and I sit with my throne of contempt and saying, look at that egomaniac. You know, look at him. Look at him. And he says, they ought to have me up there. They ought to have me up there talking. He doesn't know anything, you know. And, you know, people that say that have never done this. They have no idea how humbling it is to get in front of a group of people and just lay yourself bare and take the chance and take the risk of even talking about things that you know people aren't going to like. Because, you know, if you're going to be honest with people, if you're going to be honest with people, and talk about yourself and what's going on. You know, 25% of people are going to hate you by the time they get there. They're going to say, who invited that guy? So you got to be willing to, if you're going to be honest with people, and I'll tell you one thing, a lot of people think this is a loving program. It is, but let me tell you what I've learned. It's one of the reasons I have the time I have because of the sponsors I had is because this thing is confrontational. This is not, you know, endorsing other people's behaviors. This is about your sponsors saying things to you that cut you to the quick. Say, why don't you just go out and drink? I don't need to hear this crap. Why don't you just grow up, become a man? They say some weird things to you. I want to tell you something. All that kind of stuff. Well, at least that's the way I was brought up. So I brought this Clancy in, and he gave a talk, you know, like I'm doing tonight or something. Obviously much better than I'm doing. But he gave a talk, and everybody loved him, but I hated the talk. I was so disappointed because it wasn't the talk. He didn't do the talk that I listened to for 2 years. I wanted him to do that talk. I wanted everybody to hear that talk. So I have an email I send out with all sorts of meetings to a bunch of people, you know, and in that email I send out, I have the talk. I have John Harris's talk that I heard. I thought it's a great, now I know it's great. It was the greatest talk to me. So I share it. That's why I share it. So I don't know whether I'm going to do the talk. You know, I mean, Adam said, well, I'd listen to him and I love what he is. He says, I'm probably not going to do the talk I did that he heard 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's going to be some sort of, because you know something? Because, you know, it says somewhere, I think in the 12 and 12, it says the way we get a new perspective. Does it say this? Is by, you check me out if I'm wrong. Is by repeated humiliations, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. Does it say that? And it says that, right? So, you know, the thing about it, you know, I had a guy come up and he says, you know, time doesn't mean anything. I said, why don't you get yourself some? You see how it works out, you know? I said, let me tell you about what time is. What time is, yeah, you could have time be an idiot. But you know something? Let me tell you what time is. Time is the ability to withstand many, many, many more repeated humiliations and crushings of your self-sufficiency. And you know, over a period of time, your perception changed. You know, when I was 1 year sober, my perception of life and who I was and what I am was completely different than when I had 1 week. And when I was 5 years sober, it was completely different than when I had 1 year sober. And when I had 15 years sober, which is when Bill Wilson did the conference, you know, the conference was basically a group of people, like a business meeting, where the longest one was Bill Wilson. He had 15 years, right? Everybody else had less than 15 years until he came up with the tradition. I'm not saying anything's wrong with that, but I had 15 years. And I sponsored people. I did the whole thing. And then one day I had 30 years. How many times do you think I was humiliated and worried about things and foreclosures, and money matters, everything that between 15 years and 30 years? Do you think my perception on life and who I am, what I is changed between 15 and 30? Bill Wilson wrote a book. You know, I talked about this at the workshop this morning. He wrote a book called The Big Book. I believe it's divinely inspired. And he said in The Big Book, with 3.5 years, he said, I know it's divinely inspired because I know what I was doing at 3.5 years. I wasn't writing a book like that. And at three, and I don't think any of you guys who write a book like that 3.5 years unless you're divinely inspired, you know. But the bottom line, and what he said in The Big Book was this. He says once in a while, a drinker, person who couldn't stop drinking, alcoholic, comes in, says, I feel better, look better, have a better time. I'm excited about my sobriety, which is what I said. And then he says this. We laugh at such a Sally. We smile at such a Sally. He says, we know he's going to soon try the old game again. I never understood that until I lived it, until I lived the experience, until I was with the guys that were saying, this is great. It's fantastic. I'm never going to drink again. I'm excited. I said, that's the greatest thing to hear. This guy's going to make 40 years. And then in 6 months, they'd be drunk. And the guys that weren't talking like that, you know, they'd stay sober. I never understood. He said, every once in a while, a former drink says, feel better, look better, have a better time. We laugh at society. No, we know he's going to try. We know he's going to try the old game again because he's not happy with sobriety sooner than loneliness if you do. That's what Bill Wilson prophesied and talked about what he saw at 3.5 years. And at 22 years, he was at the end of his rope and he was depressed. And he couldn't understand what was going on. It wasn't because he stopped going to meetings or he stopped sponsoring people, because he was doing everything. He wrote the book. And he couldn't understand why it was. He couldn't understand how it was that the thing he had predicted and wrote down at 3.5 years hit him personally in the gut at 23 years. And I know enough by being around AA that there are many, many people that have 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years that drink again. I know there are many, many other people. I know there are people in this room. The newest guy is the most important thing in the room, but there's a little asterisk there. But I have a heart for people with time. Because I know if I'm in a room with this size, there's 10 or 15, there's a guy with 11 years who's going to drink in the next year and he doesn't know it. Because he's hanging in there. And he's not telling anybody about it. He doesn't even know that he has a problem, you know, until all of a sudden it happens. Maybe he gets hit by something. Maybe he gets hit by two or three things at the same time. And he's out drinking. You don't know why he's drinking because of that paragraph, Bill Wilson. There comes a time in every person's life, they'll have no defense against the first drink. It's got to come from God. And he's got everything nailed down. He knows how to do the fourth step, but he doesn't know anything about God. He'll tell you he has a relationship with God and he believes in God. He believes in the concept of God. But if you ask him, well, do you believe God? He'll say, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, because it's just a concept to him. And it's hard to have a relationship with a concept when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you have cancer. But I digress from the drunkologue. So in any event, so the bottom line is, and that's the deal. And I live my life, you know, and my life was very, very simple. I wake up every morning and said, if I only had this gal, I'd be okay. If I only have sex, I'd be okay. If I only had more money, I'd be okay. If I only had a new car, I'd be okay. I mean, it was clear to me. It was clear to me. It was so clear that if I had this, and it would give me that, and then I'd be there, and then I'd be okay. I didn't learn until I was 12 years sober. I couldn't understand. I was making good money, and I was always broke. And my sponsor explained, he says, Russell, when you spend more money than you make, you go into debt. I said, who knew that? Who knew that? My secretaries were worth more net worth than I was. You know, who knew that? Spending money with credit cards all the time. Who knew about those? Who knew about the disease of alcoholism? Because the drinking's, it's not even the disease. It's a symptom. The whoring around on your wife, it's a system. It's a symptom. The looking at other women, the running around saying, if I only had, it's a symptom. The real disease. I spent the first 10, 15, 20 years learning what this disease is really about. Why do people drink? Because all they do is deal with the symptom. Because they've been told, sold the bill of goods, which for newcomers, it's not a bad thing. As long as you don't drink, you're okay. As long as you don't drink, you raped 3 rabbits and you killed 2 women and you robbed the First National Bank of so-and-so. Hey, but did you have a drink? You haven't had a drink yet. Come here and pick up your medallion. You got 10 years. You got 10 years. And you know what Bill Wilson said? He said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I got to keep talking about and telling other people. He gave all credit to God. And the guy who wrote Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, he said he called that the, what was that? That's the great, what is it? What is the name for that again? The golden text of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then you know what Bill said? He said, I needed God. I wanted God. And he came. And he came. And I needed God and I wanted God and he came. But you know what Bill Wilson said? But soon the worldly clamors of my life came around and blotted out his presence. Have you guys noticed that no matter how long you're sober, the worldly clamors never stop? They're 24/7. They're all, but you know, it's almost like your mortgage company doesn't even understand. They don't say, hey, you know, we know you're sober. You're trying to stay sober. Forget the mortgage. We know you're trying to stay sober. Forget the traffic jam. Forget the problems, you know? They don't seem to care about that. It's always 24/7. We never apologize for God. All men of faith have courage. They trust in God. Instead, they let him demonstrate through their testimony what he's done for them. At once begin to outgrow fear. Have you stopped worrying about what other people think about you? Do you ever worry about what people are thinking about you? You know, the big book says one of the promises, it's rarely talked about. I think the reason why it's rarely talked about is I think most alcoholics don't have it, so they can't talk about it. I think they still have anxiety. You know, one time my house was foreclosed on. It never got foreclosed. It got saved. You know, I think the Lord did that, but it was foreclosed on. And you know what I worried about? I'd like to say I worried about where am I going to live, but I knew I was going to be okay. I was going to live somewhere. I mean, I wasn't going to starve. You know what I worried about? I worried about what people would think about me if they knew my house was foreclosed on. You know, you lose a job. You know, you worry about money and things like that, you know. It's not important. It's just right up there with oxygen. But you know what I worry about? What would people think about if they knew I didn't have a lot of money? It always came down to the real bedrock deal, the real disease. What will people think about me? What will people in AA think about me? You know, that actually saved me at one time, and I'll talk about that. But even so, every day I'd wake up and say, if only I had this, I'd be okay. If only I had that, I'd be okay. Never realizing that what I was saying to myself is I'm not okay. I'm not okay. And so I chase that stuff. I chase that stuff, and then I get it, and then I wasn't okay. And then I'd say, well, if I only had a newer car or a different woman or something like that, I'd be okay. And you're chasing and chasing. You're never okay. You're okay for a sec. It's like women are like boo. I said, I was in AA. I said to my sponsor, look at that blonde in the front row. Because my whole life was, look at that blonde in the front row. Look at that gal in the front row. My sponsor said, what do you used to drink? I said, scotch. He said, well, what kind of scotch? He says, J&B. He says, you see that gal in the front row? I said, yeah. He says, for you, that woman is a bottle of scotch with legs. And I looked at him because he used to say a lot of stupid things, you know? You know, old times. And I looked at him and And I thought it was stupid. Then every once in a while, I'd see a gal and a green bottle would form around her. You know what I mean? And they put this crap in your head, you know? And so one day I'm sitting in, I was sitting in one of my classes, fixing to graduate, and some gal walks in and she's got legs up to here. She's a cheerleader. I look at her. She looks at me and I say, man, if I only had that gal, I'd be okay. You know? I only had that gal, I'd be okay. And so I'd do the alcoholic full court press on that lady. You know, I said, I want that gal. That gal will make everything come together for me. And, you know, these little stories we have, you know, I came in there, I didn't have any story. My story was like, you know, it's not my fault. I'm not to blame. You know, some other dude did it. You know, if it wasn't for this, I'd be, you know, and you don't really have a story. You can't even come at alcoholics directly. You can't say, well, this is your, you know, you gotta flank them. You're sitting here in a room, you hear some guy talking, hey, you say, man, that guy is crazy. And then all of a sudden you say, holy crap, I was doing that last week, you know? And that's how you learn you're crazy. Nobody can tell you you're crazy. You just learn you're crazy because you listen to somebody doing crazy stuff. You say, that's what I do. And so he came in, if I only had that guy, I'd be okay. So I worked my way. I insinuated myself in that guy. Her father was a doctor. Her mother was a lawyer. Her grandfather was a lawyer. It's just a group of professionals. And I was going to be a math teacher, PhD, you know, higher math and everything like that. I loved math. Took all the courses, all the PhD, everything like that. And I woke up one morning and I said, you know, I shouldn't be. And I've been working at that for like 12 years. I said, I shouldn't be a math teacher. They don't make any money. You know something? I ought to be a lawyer. People would ask me, why'd you become a lawyer? I said, well, because I like Perry Mason and I like this and I like that. And you know, the big book says alcoholics are delusional. They can't tell the truth from the false. Their alcoholic life seems their only normal one. You know, I read that part. It says selfishness, self-centeredness, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We step on the toes of others. They retaliate, seemingly without provocation. But we learn that we made decisions based upon our selfishness. It puts us in a position to be hurt. So alcohol is self-rule run right, though they usually don't think so. You remember that part. So I asked my sponsor. My sponsors were very mean to me. They weren't nice. I was supposed to be sponsored by Jesus Christ or, you know, Albert Einstein. They gave me some old fart who didn't even graduate the sixth grade. And so I read him that part. I said, what does that mean? He says, Russell, what that means is you don't give a crap about anybody except yourself. I said, ooh, I like the way they say it in the big book better. I don't like the way you say it. You know, me, you know. So I insinuated myself. She says, why did you become a lawyer? And I'd say it's because I'm a good guy. I like, you know, whatever the heck I said, Perry Mason TV. And I became a lawyer to get in some gal's pants. That sort of tells you about my integrity. I'm going to be what I'm going to be and do what I'm going to do to ingratiate myself with somebody and get what I want. That's who I really am. I'm not a spiritual guy. I'm the Madonna of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a material girl in a material world. I used to tell people I was spiritual, but now I know exactly what I am. I know exactly what I am. And it's good to know exactly who you are, because then you know exactly what you need. And you know what's waiting for you if you don't get it. You know, so it's a good thing. So I insinuated myself in this gal's life, and what I'm going to tell you now has to do, let's just assume the fact that I couldn't stop drinking. Because I did get to that point. I think I got to the point the first time I took a drink, but in any event. So I insinuated I married that gal. Had a baby. Moved into a big house on Miami Beach on the golf course. Became a division chief in the state attorney's office trying murder cases. Was about 150 pounds lighter than I am now. Had the blue suit. Had the white shirt. I had the yellow or red tie. You know, and I had power, you know, indicting, I'd go in and indict people and, you know, put them in jail for 100 years or life or go for the death. And I could do that stuff, you know, very heady stuff for an alcoholic. And I used to go after, and so I'm married to this gal and I'm drinking. And, I used to sit there in the Alibi Lounge, my bar, because I'm a bar drinker. You know, so it was my bar. Don't be rearranging the furniture without telling me. You know what I mean? And I'd be sitting there with my drinking buddies, the only guys who really understood me. And And I'd be sitting there drinking, and I'd sit there with the, and I'd be looking at the blondes and the brunettes and the redheads, and I'd be saying things like this: man, if I only wasn't married, I could have one of those. I want to tell you, I'm very proud of myself. I never once physically cheated on my wife. All I did was Monday through Friday, I would just sit there in the bar until 3 o'clock in the morning while my wife was at home with dinner and the baby, and think about cheating on my wife and tell myself, if I only had that, if I only wasn't married, I could have that one. You know, if I only had that one, I'd be okay. And I don't know how long it took to do that. Maybe about a year of marriage, maybe about 6 months of marriage. I don't know how long it took. So one day I came home because I come home drunk all the time at 2 o'clock in the morning and being very proud of the fact that I didn't cheat on my wife, you know, although considering how wonderful I am, I should have had a right to do that. But the reason I didn't do that, the reason I didn't cheat on my wife is because I'm basically a coward. You know, I'd like to say because I'm a good guy, I'm a coward, worried about getting caught and everything, and their parents love me and everything like that. And so I came home one day and here's what happened. My wife told me on a Friday, and I was dressed like I am right now. And she said, I was as sober as I am right now, physically sober. And she said, I just want you to know, it was like dropping off the mail. She said, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Period. That's it. Wasn't even sudden. Just walked out the door. And I heard that, you know, I didn't understand it. You know, I really didn't understand it with all the degrees and all that. I didn't have a clue as to what she was like. I mean, she said, if you don't pay more attention to me, it's not that kind of stuff like that. Things that wives say, I didn't understand that. So I got in my car and I got to the first red light. And this is what I said to myself. I'll never forget. I said, what the hell did she mean by that? It's very confusing. I used to deal with the Schrodinger wave equation, Heidelberg uncertainty principle, you know, multivariable calculus, if you come home drunk, 12 words, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I said, what does that mean? You know, and it's very confusing. It's very confusing to a guy like me. I mean, I drank before we got married. She knew I was a drinker. So I went into the bar. I went to my bar. You know, you always get there at 4:30. As I was pulling into the bar, I would start feeling the effects of getting drunk and feeling good as I pulled into the parking space next to the bar. That's how it worked with me. The obsession would make me feel. And I walked in the bar. I sat down at the bar and I'd order one drink. I knew I could only stay for one drink because I was half a while away from my house. So, you know, and I take, and then I could get to my house and my buddy Doug Hartman came up to me, one of my drinking buddies. I say, give me a double scotch. I go, whack. He said, they never said I drank a lot. I just drank fast because I wanted to get to that place, you know, that spot where I really didn't give a crap. You know, I'd walk in that bar worrying about what the group would think about me and I'd have a couple of shots. I felt like I owned the group. You know what booze does for you? You can go up to, you're scared to go up to a gal and ask her to dance because she'll, you know, puke on you. Say, you kidding me? And, you know, I'd have a couple of shots. I could ask anybody to dance, you know, and she'd say, you, I'm not going to dance with you. I said, hey, you're lost, baby. You know, that's what it did for me. It took me to that place. You know what I mean? I'm John Wayne. And so I take that whack of the drunk and I said to my buddy, Doug Hartman, I said, Doug, I can't stay. Everything that's important to me, my wife, my kids, and everything were on the line. All I had to do was make it home. I said, I can't stay. And I said, Ronnie said to me, if I come home drunk one more time, she's going to leave me. I quoted it exactly. I can't stay. I got to leave. Doug puts his arm around me, as only drinking buddies can, the people that really care about you. He said, Russell, we love you. I love you. Everybody here loves you. You are the greatest guy in the world. Your wife adores you. Your wife loves you. Your wife will never leave you. And I think, man, that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, that's why. You don't need a psychiatrist. All you need is drinking buddies, you know? And so it seemed like a good idea. It was only 15 minutes away. I have another drink. I whack down another drink and another drink. And next thing you know, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. They pour me in and that was the end of my marriage. I came home drunk and she kicked me out. And, you know, I'd like to see as I'm leaving my house and leaving my car, my house and my wife and my three-year-old son and walking away from everything that's important to me and should have been important to me, I like to say I felt sad. I was excited because I was free. Now you could say, well, why didn't you just ask your wife for divorce? Because I'm chicken. Because all men who don't have faith are cowards. And I was a coward, you know, and that's why. But she kicked me out, so it wasn't my fault. You understand? My wife divorced me. So somewhere along, we filed for divorce, and somewhere along the line, she says something like, we ought to go to a marriage counselor, because now get this, that stuff you do, you know, when you get married, anybody here have been get married? You know, there's a thing they say, till death do you part. I mean, it's like a death sentence, you know? I mean, it's like my second wife, I married 45 years. My second wife, I got married after I was 3 months sober. My sponsor said, don't make any major moves. I didn't think it was a big deal. I was wrong, by the way, but I got married. And she said, are we going to be together in heaven? I said, sweetie, it's till death do us part. Don't be looking for me. Now, so, yeah, I read the contract. I'm a lawyer. So in any event, my wife, who apparently took the vow seriously, I went for a party where they had ice sculptures and everything at Westview Country Club. And she had whatever it is you have as a human being, where you actually have the integrity to believe that our marriage vow is sacred. I didn't understand that stuff because I don't know what sacred means, because I believe in American Express, Playboy magazine, you know, going out there and having sex. I just believe in rock and roll and, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And God had nothing to do with anything, you know. And neither did anybody I drank with. And so I went to see the psychiatrist because I felt, you know, guilty, because I was guilty, by the way. And I went to see the psychiatrist. And I like to tell this story because, you know, sometimes you'll tell a story and it'll be just one lousy little story and it'll tell you everything you need to know about everything. That's the great thing about it. So I may have two, I actually have 200-300 stories. You can't tell, you know, you can tell maybe two. Some guy comes up and he says, why don't you tell the story about the Camaro? Why don't you tell the story about the crazy priest? I said, you don't understand. I tell three stories. That's the hour. You know what I mean? I can't tell him. I know you like that story, but here's the deal. I went up to, I go to the marriage counselor and he asked my wife, and I had a date that night with a redhead. And so I'm sitting there and he asked my wife this. He says, what are the three things you want to change with Russell? And my wife said, told him three. I don't know what she said. I think she probably said, so I wasn't even listening. I swear to God, I felt like the movie Godfather. I tried to get out and they dragged me back. I had this date. I'm finally getting divorced. I don't have to worry. I don't have to feel guilty. She's kicking me out. And now this is like dragging me back. And I think she mentioned something about coming home for dinner. I don't know. Maybe about drinking. I don't know. And she was a wonderful gal. She's a great gal. There's nothing wrong with her. And, you know, you remember this gal? You remember who she was? She was the one, if I only had her, I'd be okay. Remember? You know, my second wife said, if you buy me a boba, I'll never ask for anything else. That was a lie from the pit of hell. I can tell you that. You know, well, she's an Al-Anon. Our ladies of perpetual revenge. What can I tell you? So the bottom line is, so he turns to me. And he says this, what are the three things you want to change about Ronnie? And I look at him as sober as I am right now, and I say, I just want to date other women. Really? Really? What a jerk, right? What an idiot. You know, really, not as righteous as you guys. But you want to know something? That's who I am. That's who I am. I'm not a spiritual guy. I'm not a nice guy. I'm a good guy. I'm a lawyer in a three-piece suit that can put on a good act and can talk before a jury and look like I'm intelligent, but in the end, I don't give a crap about anybody except myself. That's the kind of alcoholism I suffer from. You may suffer from a different type of alcoholism. You know how it says in the book, we will not regret the past or wish to, you know, I made all my amends, including my amends to my wife who married somebody else and I liked them and we amends to everybody and all that sort of stuff. But you want something? I will always regret how I treated my wife. I will always, that scar will always be there. And, you know, I had to figure out what does that mean? Well, you know, the big book, you know, I love the big book. I memorized it. I know the big book. And, you know, but you know what they say in the big book? We know only a little. Isn't that what they say that? We know only a little. God will disclose to us things. Don't figure out that everything you're going to learn about God and who you are and what you are is within the confines of the big book. They're reading other books between 1935 and 1940. And you know, at 23 years sober, you know what Bill Wilson said when he was going down the tubes? And he started looking at people and he said there were people that were breaking free. He said, perhaps these will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA. Whatever that is, it has something to do with the fellowship of the Spirit, not the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship of the Spirit. I don't know what that is, but we'll figure it out. You know what he said? You're not going to believe this. 23 years sober, he says, I got it all wrong. I depended too much on AA. I depended too much upon people. I depended too much upon myself. You know what he was talking about? He said, I missed the God thing. That's why the last words Dr. Bob said to Bill was an exhortation. Let's not screw this thing up. Keep it simple. You know, it's very easy when you get your double digit, your medallion and this, and you're doing all this stuff and you're staying sober and you're having a good time and you got all these friends, like another bar, except they serve coffee instead, and you feel good about yourself. It's very easy to subconsciously think that the reason you're sober and you're doing relatively okay is because you're doing all this stuff. Because of what you're doing, that you're keeping yourself sober without even knowing it. And if somebody says, you believe in God? Yeah, I believe in God. But the truth is, he's not the central fact of your life. You haven't been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. You don't know heaven. You don't know peace because you don't know the great fact. Because God is not the central fact of your life, and you're not convinced he lives in your heart and mind in a way which is deep. Miraculous. I talked to two guys the other day when I was speaking up in the Blue Ridge. Two guys, and they told me they don't believe in miracles. I said, then you don't believe in God. You're a miracle. He says, no, we don't think that. You know? He said, I believe in God. I said, do you believe God? He said, I don't understand what you're talking about. I said, I know you don't. Because you say you believe in the concept of God. Like, I believe in my car. I believe in the world. I believe in nature. But you don't believe God. Because you don't know who God is. Because you got 30 years, so what do you need God for? You don't drink and you go to meetings. But you still worry about what people think about you. You still worry about it. You haven't figured out that promise yet. Have you? Well, just that kind of deal. But that's not for me. That's where we each have our own little journey. So one day, so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got my first sponsor. I'm skipping a part, okay? I'm going to do this briefly, and this is just happens to be my story. It doesn't have to be your story. So I got divorced from my wife. I was going to be the Hugh Hefner of Miami, Florida. But in order to do that, you know, with the girls, you got to be able to stand up without falling down, and I was having problems with that. One night, I got a divorce, and I was doing whatever we do, running around to the Playboy Club and everything like that, and doing my thing, and being a lawyer in Miami, and then some gal named Daisy invited me to a Noche Buena, which is what the Latinas do on the night before Christmas, Christmas Eve, and it's a big party and everything. She invited me to the party. And of course, I was drunk before I got to the party. I was drunk in the party. And her father said, this kid, guy's drunk, get rid of him. I got kicked out on Christmas Eve. Can you imagine it? I mean, Frank Sinatra, one of my guys, you know, used to say Saturday night is the loneliest night of the week. I'll tell you what's lonelier, to be by yourself on Christmas Eve when you know everybody has somebody. And I'm at home, and I have nobody, and I have nothing. And I've just been kicked out of a Christmas party. And, you know, my idea, as long as I had a gal, as long as I could find some wounded creature who was nice looking, who would take me in, I'd say, I'm okay. I'm okay. That was enough to prop up my ego. I'm okay. And I didn't have that anymore. And I thought my life was over and it was never going to get better again. I felt like Bill Wilson, I guess, on the bed when he screamed out, if there is a God, please show it to me. And I turned on a TV set. Simple as that. Some preacher came on. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, he started talking about the Lord. And, you know, he says, if you feel your life is over and you got no place else to give your life to the Lord. And he says, everything will be changed. He'll change everything. And he said, if you want to do that, get on your knees and say this prayer. And I got on my knees like a shot. You know, and believe me, I don't know the Bible. I don't know what God means. I just said the prayer. You know, I gave my life to the Lord. I asked the Lord to come into my life. And 2 o'clock in the morning, You know, I actually sometimes struggle. I don't struggle with it. That's not the word. My sobriety date is January 25th, 1981. But my born again date, I'm convinced, is December 25th, the month before that, you know, 1980. And yeah, well, I'm old, so you don't know what it's like. So in any event, so here's the deal. I went to sleep and I continue to drink. And that doesn't mean anything to me except the Lord works in strange ways. He sometimes starts rearranging the furniture before you stop drinking. And less than 1 month later, I got into an accident. It almost killed me. I was on a hospital gurney. I said, God help me. And something happened to me. And all I know is that exactly 1 month later after that, I had my last drink. Cold can of course beer while I was hooked up in the hospital. Doug Hartman brought it to me. My drinking buddy came to the hospital, as a true drinking buddy is, and he took out of a cooler cold glass of Coors beer, and I whacked it on down. That's the last drink I ever had, at least to date. Some guy came to the hospital. My mother sent him, named Bob Sullivan, who ended up being my first sponsor. Remember that guy? You know? And he told me two things I'll never forget. He said, you never have to drink anymore if you don't want to. And I didn't know that. I didn't know I never had to drink anymore. People would say, why do you drink? Why can't you stop drinking? Or all that sort of stuff. But I didn't know I didn't have to drink if I didn't want to. He says, you never have to feel the way you're feeling now if you don't want to. And I didn't want to feel the way I felt. Next thing I know, like a week or two later, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous and with 100 or 200 people in the South Dade room. And all I know is I'm looking around and I have this feeling I'm going to be all right. I had this feeling I was going to be all right. Didn't know any of them. They picked up the white chip. Anybody want? I went up there and the big shot lawyer went up there and grabbed that, basically sort of announced, you know, I'm the newest guy in the room and I need help. And I didn't mind. I just grabbed that sucker and Bob became my sponsor. Let me just tell a couple stories about Bob. Interesting stories. I've had four sponsors, all incredible people and a mentor named Ray O'Keefe and a wonderful guy. And tell you a couple stories. I was, you know, I have so many stories, but I only have time for a couple of them. And, I was, when I was about 3 months sober, not 3 months, three months sober, I went to a meeting at the keynote group. Bob took me there, and there was a guy speaking named Al Kennedy. Al had about 40 years. He was about 70 years old or something like that, and he was giving a talk, and I'm a sucker for good AA talks, and I'm listening to this guy. I'm like enthralled by this guy. I'm the front row. I'm listening to this guy. I just love this guy. He was lifting up people. He was loving on people. You know, people loved him. And he stopped him and, you know, he finished and everybody clapped and started to leave. And I turned to my sponsor and I said, man, that guy's great. What do you, I want to hang him out. Where does he go to meetings? And he says, oh, he's dying. I didn't think I understood it. I said, I'm talking about the guy who just did the meeting. I said, where does he go to meetings? He says, he's dying. I said, I'm talking about the guy who just spoke, Al Kennedy. He says, Russell, I don't know what to tell you. He's dying. He's got cancer. He's got 6 months to live. And I said, well, he didn't say anything about dying. If I have a hangnail, that's good for five meetings. You know what I mean? He didn't say anything about dying. He says, I know, but he was just trying to help people. I said, I know, but he's dying. And he was happier than anybody in the room. And all of a sudden, my idea of what this thing was all about went from not drinking to some other place. That I said, why can't I want to have what that guy has? I want that thing. You know, that's what I want to have. One day I was, and that's always been my vision. Why can't I have that kind of sobriety where I'm dying and I'm not scared of it? And I've found a lot of people that have that sobriety. I hung around them, you know. One day, some guy who had an AA bounced a $500 check on me, caused me to bounce a bunch of $500 checks. And a bunch of checks, actually. And I couldn't stop thinking about how this guy did that to me and how he bounced checks. I mean, you know, this is, you know, you got about 6 months sober and, you know, you're someone and a wife and a couple kids and everything like that. And checks are bouncing and they're not paying you. And I'm talking about this guy and this guy did this and this guy can't stop thinking about this guy. You know what he did? I had what's called a resentment. You know that, you know, and you know, I mean, there's ways of getting rid of it, but I couldn't get rid of this thing. My sponsor comes up to me, Bob Sullivan. And he says to me, you know, keep on talking about this guy. He says, he bounced a $500 check on me. You know what I say? I'm an alcoholic. I said, if it happened to you, you'd not. Yeah. If it happened to you, you'd do the same. You'd feel the same way because I believe that there's no other way of feeling. There is no other way of doing life. And he said, well, he said, let me ask you a question. He said, what? I said, what? He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? And I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. He says, simple question. How would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, Bob, I swear to God, I don't understand what you're talking about. He said, look, Russ, this is simple. Read my lips. How would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, I am being honest with you. Guy bounced off. What do you mean? How would I feel if it didn't bother me? He said, it's very simple. How would you feel if it didn't bother you? You mean, how would I feel if it didn't bother me that he bounced a $500 check on me? On you? On me? He said, absolutely. How would you feel? And I thought about it. I said, well, if it didn't bother me, I'd feel okay. And he said, there you go. And he walked away. He walked away. And then one day I was broke. I was 4 or 5 months sober and I was broke. And I was broke. I didn't have any money. The big shot lawyer had $50 in the bank. I was 2 months behind in my rent. I had a wife, a kid, everything like that. I couldn't even talk to her. I couldn't talk to anybody. I could have talked to my group. I'm not going to tell my group. Not that I care what they think about me. You know what I mean? I'm not going to tell them I don't have any money. You know what I mean? And finally, I couldn't get to sleep at night. I woke up thinking about the money, going to sleep thinking about the money. You know, I think I had that fear of financial thing. And I went up to my sponsor and I said, and I told him the whole story. That I didn't have any money. And he looks at me and he says, you know, I can solve that. I said, really? He says, absolutely. It's easy. I can solve that problem. And I'm getting ready. I got my cashier's mitt out. I'm getting ready for a couple of $1,000 coming in from my sponsor, which, you know, if he really loved me, he'd take care of that. You know what I mean? And let me tell you, so if you had a sponsor, he doesn't give you all that money, you need to get another sponsor. So in any event, I'm lying about that. But in any event, so I went up, I told him, he says, no, we can take care of that. He says, really? He says, absolutely. And the meeting finishes, he says, follow me. And he starts showing me how to make coffee for the group. He says, this is what you need to do. You need to start making coffee for the group and how to set up the chairs and everything like that. And that was his solution. And I'm saying to myself, I'm not sure I really explained myself properly. I'm not sure he really, I'm talking money. You know what I mean? And I made coffee for that damn group for 18 months. And, you know, after 3 months, the money came in. And yeah, the next day after he told me that, I started showing how to make coffee. No money came in. I was very depressed. You know, we get very depressed. So I wasn't going to go to the meeting, but I had to go to the meeting because I had to make the stupid coffee, because what would the group think about me if I didn't show up to make the coffee? So the thing that used to kill me out there actually saved my life, because I went there not because I wanted to get that. I didn't want people to think badly of me. So I made the damn coffee for another 3 months. The money came in. Everything was okay. Some guy came up and he says, I'll make the coffee. I said, I'm the coffee maker. Who the hell appointed you? Made coffee for 18 more months, you know? So my sponsor eventually died, and I got another sponsor, Joe Snyder, and he's an incredible man. I got all sorts of stories about him. And one story I'll tell you about him, which is important to me, is when I was 10 years sober and 10 years married, my wife said something to me, and it really, we had an argument. We had a big argument. And I said, this marriage is over. This marriage is over. I didn't come in here for this crap. I am gone. So I went up to my sponsor, Bob, and I said, and really, sponsors are stupid. I mean, I don't know what it is with them. You know, I'm bright. And I went up to my sponsor. I said, listen, he said, I'm getting a divorce. I got a divorce. He says, really? Why? He says, yeah, I didn't sign up for this crap. I didn't sign up for this. And I was going to meetings. I was doing everything. I sponsored everything that moved. I was 8 years on Relay. You called up in Dade County, Miami-Dade County, Florida, to ask, find somebody in AA. You got me on the phone, which is why nobody got sober for 8 years. But in any event, some guy called me up and he says, I'm out on the street. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I need to go to an AA meeting. I'm drinking. I need help. I said, well, okay, where are you located? He says, no, I need a cab. I said, I need somebody to pick. I said, hey, we're not a cab company, buddy. You know what I mean? I know where you are. You're like a mile and a half away from this meeting. You go walking there, and in the next 2 hours, you'll be that at the meeting. You wait there until it opens up at 9 o'clock. And you'll be, he looked at me. He said, you're not going to pick me up? You're not going to send a cab out? He says, no, you walk for this way an hour and you'll be at an AA meeting. He said, well, that's not the way they do it in Connecticut. I said, He said, what's your name? Now I know I'm dealing with an alcoholic. What's your name? My name's Russell. Your last name? I said, don't worry. They know who I am. It's Russell. Russell's the guy who answers the phone for 8 years. Russell. I said, you're not going to report me, are you? I would hate to lose this job. You know why I've had this job for 8 years? Nobody else wants it. You know? Hate for them to take it away from me, you know? So, Bob, I go up to Joe Snyder, and I say, I got to divorce her. And I tell him exactly what she did. And I can tell you, if it was Doug Hartman, I told him what she did, she'd say, kick her to the curb. If it was anybody I drank with, he'd say, you don't need that crap, Russell. Get rid of her. You know what I mean? So I told Joe Snyder everything she did, and what she did was monstrous, very disrespectful. And she said, and Joe said to me, he says, so why are you upset? Well, I'll tell you one thing about alcoholics. I don't know about what kind of alcoholism you have, but the alcoholism I have is I know mathematically to the precise decimal why I'm upset. I may not know shit, but I know one thing. I know why I'm upset. You know what I mean? He said, why are you upset? I said, what do you mean? He says, why are you upset? I said, Bob, I just spoke for 20 minutes. I told you exactly why I was upset. And he looks at me and he says, that's not why you're upset. And I said, what do you mean that's not why I'm upset? He says, that's not why you're upset. You mean all that stuff I told you 20 minutes to tell you the details? She said this, and I said, he says, no, that's not why you're upset. What about when she said, he says, that's not why you're upset. Or he says, that's not why you're upset. And I said, well, but that's not why you're upset. And he just sat there staring at me. And something in my mind, you know, the way he was looking at me, almost like he knew why I was upset. And I'll tell you something, being extremely interested in me, my favorite topic, the idea that he might know something I don't know, it's just killing me. I said, do you know why I'm upset? He said, absolutely. You know why I'm upset? It's clear. Well, you're going to tell me why I'm upset? I don't know. Do you really want to know? He said, of course I want to know. Why am I upset? And he said, I'll never forget these words. This is an exact quote. He said, listen, stupid, which was my nickname, by the way, because I was. He said, you're upset. And this is with 10 years sobriety. You're upset because you're upsettable. I said, what is that, like Zen AA or something? You know what he was telling me? He told me the same thing Bob Sullivan said to me 10 years before that. Don't you remember? I was 6 months sober. Guy bounced a $150 check on me, a $500 check on me. And he said, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? You remember that? And I said, well, if it didn't bother me, I'd feel fine. And he walked away. 10 years, I hadn't learned that lesson. I thought I was okay because I picked up I had double digits. He said, you're upset because you're upsettable. You know what happens when you work on not being upsettable? When instead of conforming yourself to everybody in AA, you decide to believe in God and become transformed into a different human being? Maybe like St. Francis or somebody like that. We're not saints, but maybe you look at people that have been transformed. And all of a sudden your wife says something to you and you say, yeah. And all of a sudden it starts rolling off your back and you know what happens when all of a sudden things aren't upsetting you and you don't get scared and you lose fear of people and that's not been security. You know what happens? It's not that you get rich. It's not that you don't have times when you're low on money. It's not that your wife doesn't say horrible things to you or horrible things don't happen. It just doesn't sting. And somehow AA has a way. It's like when you go to the doctor, when they go to give you medicine, they say, you're going to feel a pinch and then the medicine comes. It's like AA. You know, you go see a doctor and he says, listen, stupid. And you feel the pinch and then comes the medicine. And I got a million stories about that. Guys coming up to me and first giving me a shot in the solar plexus and say, listen, stupid, this is the deal. Because my mind is so strong, I don't want to listen to you. I want you to listen to me. I want to either cut you off in mid-sentence or wait till you're done and saying, yeah, I understand, but let me explain. You don't understand. I want to cancel everything you say, and I want you to come to my side and let me know that I am a victim. And it's not my fault. And it's their fault. That's an alcoholic life. So I'm going to tell you one last story. There's so many of them, but I'm not going to do that to you because you got important things to do. I want to tell you a recent story about my, I will tell you two stories. If you don't mind. I got a third sponsor. My third sponsor was John Glenn. I met him one of the things that happened was I started going down the tubes and I asked the man, what should I do? I told him how I was 10 years sober, 11 years sober. And I wasn't feeling, I was like Bill Wilson. If you ever read The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety, you'll see what Bill Wilson says to himself. How he's going downhill, sober. And there may be people in here who reached the second bottom. Bill Wilson reached it at around 22 years. I reached it at 10 years, where I was doing everything and I was going down the tubes. I went up to a friend of mine who wasn't even in AA. And I told him what was going on. He says, you need to go to Bible study. Not leave AA, but you need to go to Bible. You need to start getting seriously into, I know you can handle resentments. I know you use the tools. I know you do all that stuff, but you need to start focusing. And, there is a line in the big book that says, God is everything or he's nothing. Half measures avail us nothing. There is no middle of the road solution. You need to get serious about that. I know they've been telling you, don't worry about the God thing. You better start worrying about it at this point because you got to get to another level. You got to get to something called the fellowship of the spirit. Like they say in the last page where they say, but we won't know you. He says, you don't have to know us. Your real reliance has to be God. Will show you to create the fellowship you crave. You better get involved in another fellowship. Another fellowship where they take God seriously. You gotta start getting this stuff seriously so you can join the fellowship of the spirit. And I didn't know about that. And I explained to him that I'm spiritual, not religious. And he said, well, you do whatever you want to do. But I was feeling so bad. Next week, I'm on myself in a Bible study. And I've been doing that for the last 30 years, whatever it is. But I met a man in the Bible study who was 55 years sober. His name was John Glenn. He used to call himself, not the John Glenn. He used to call me, he says, I'm John Glenn, future astronaut. When he was dying and I watched him die, he used to say, Russ, my bags are packed. I'm ready to go. He had that Al Kennedy thing where he was looking forward to dying. His wife had died and he was looking forward to it. And I've met many men like that. It's a whole different deal. And he used to say things, the stuff he used to say to me, we'd go to restaurants. We all hold hands here and say the Lord's Prayer. We'd go to restaurants with 100, 200 people. And I'd go to eat and he'd say, Russ, what are you doing? I said, I'm eating. He says, we got to give thanks first. We got to give thanks first. And he would bow his head and start saying one of these long Baptist prayers. And I'm looking around to see who's looking at me. You know why? Because I was worried about what some guy who's not even paying my visa bill, who's sitting at the table next to me, what he's thinking about me, and nobody was looking at me. And I did, you hang around with guys like that for 10, 20, 30 years. Let me tell you something. You start all of a sudden making God the central factor of your life, thinking about God all the time. You don't have to turn things over because you're living a turned over life. You wake up in the morning, think about God. You go to sleep thinking about God. I can multitask. I can do my job. I can be in court. I can be talking to a jury and I'm thinking about God. I can, believe it or not, while I'm up here, think about God. I can think about God before I get up here. As a matter of fact, if I do that, talk seems to get better. I don't know about that. Instead of thinking about making people like me or stuff like that. So, I mean, that was John Glenn. But here's a little story about what happened just a year ago, which sort of tells you like the difference between what's going on now, who I am now, and what I used to be. You remember what he said? He said, what did Joe Snyder say to me? He said, you're upset because you're upsettable. Isn't that what he said? You're upset because you're upsettable. Well, you guys know my wife. You know how she is, So I hope you feel sorry for me. So one day, about 6, 8 months ago, I walk out of my bedroom and I walk out into the foyer, into the living room. And my wife is coming from the outside with this huge box. It's about this high, about this wide, you know what I mean? And she brings in this giant appliance. She's dragging it in. She puts it down on the floor and it says pressure cleaner. And I can tell because like Price is Right, I can tell that's $400 to $500. So I'm starting off the day. Now I have to have a certain amount of money every month come in order to keep my head above water. And I'm starting out the day, and I'm now $400 in the hole, Not that I care about money or anything like that, but you guys are spiritual, not religious, and I'm a material man in a material world. And so I say to myself, oh, look at that. My wife bought that because we have Amazon deliver everything. I don't know what it is with that deal, but so I say to her, Oh, you bought a pressure cleaner. He says, yeah, yeah, for the outside. I said, oh. So then she walks outside again. This is a true story. You can't make this stuff up. And she drags in another pressure cleaner. Same exact thing. Now I'm $1,000 in the hole. And I say to her, I say, oh, you bought two. And she says, yes, I did. And then I say, I don't know what you would say. I'd say, I said, nice as you please, really, you know, because I'm sober, you know, a few years. I said, why'd you buy two? And she says, remember, this gal is going to divorce because of what she said. She says to me, because I wanted two. Yeah, you think it's funny. You don't know what it's like. Well, it's not your money, and I can tell you that. And so I'm about to say something. The words are forming in my brain. I know exactly what the sentence is going to sound like, and it has an F word in it. I mean, I got to be honest with you. It does. You know, I'm not well yet. And it's about to come out, and I'm going to say it a little bit of a religious way because the Lord captured it. Something came into my brain and just captured that sucker, took that deal away. And it replaced it with this. I heard this voice. It said, Russell, you just got the best answer you're ever going to get from this woman. You know, it's like, what's that movie, you know, where it's Lost in Space? Danger, Robinson, danger. You know, you just did the best, you know, you ever said. And I said, and I didn't say a word. I just smiled and walked away. Now for the rest of the story. 2 days later, I'm walking into my backyard by the pool area and everything like that. And I do a Saturday workshop, a three-hour workshop. And a bunch of my sponsees are there. And we do it on a big screen and we can see everybody and everything like that. And my wife is out there with the pressure cleaner. She's just standing there with the pressure cleaner. And she's just standing there sort of looking at the pressure cleaner. I said, what's going on? He says, well, the pressure cleaner's not working. So I say, I don't know what you'd say. I said, well, just get the other pressure cleaner. She said, I knew you couldn't let it go. Well, for your information, I bought that for my cousin. Are you satisfied? And I'm thinking, man, she's been carrying that hand grenade. That's got to be hurting. She's been carrying that thing. Must have killed her that I didn't say anything, you know, carrying that for 2 days. And then I start thinking, this is a great AA story. This is like a gift from heaven. And I got witnesses. Three of my sponsees were there. She can't deny it. See, we're there when it happened. So I guess it really does have to do with whether you're upsettable or not. I guess that's what it has to do with. Because life is going to keep on coming and testing you. I guess it has to do with that deal. Not taking yourself so seriously. Not being upsettable. That's how you find out what's really going on. And if you find that you think a lot about whether people like you or not, or you worry about that stuff, you worry about money a lot, or you find yourself sober and you got double-digit sobriety, but you're still anxious, and sometimes you still wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you might want to, I'm just suggesting, sort of lift it up to the next level. Thank you very much.